So basically, it caused a stalemate for the vice presidency voting out of Virginia because people like Tyler so much. But because of all this hullabaloo, Tyler ends up gaining like all this national attention. Right. And he's seen as this unique animal, a states' rights-focused Whig, which it just doesn't exist.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, podcast that digs deep in the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name is Kyle, the blank to Eric's blank, and forgot to fill that in. I figure I only get one of those in the season.
You can definitely do the blank to his blank.
I can do that once. I only get that joke once. Maybe I could pull that off when we get to the 30s. Yeah, today is the John Tyler Show. And here is something I want to point out, too. By the time that this episode is airing, it has been 4 weeks from episode one of William Henry Harrison to episode one of John Tyler, if my math is right. And that means that we have actually timed our coverage of William Henry Harrison to be the length of his presidency.
That was
that's kind of cool, right?
I don't want to like say it, but I think we did a good job with William Henry Harrison.
I was very, very happy. So what are we saying here? Okay, 4 weeks after your inauguration, the hero of Tippecanoe is dead, and it's the John Tyler Show. Boy, John Tyler. Did anybody have a tougher stage set for them? Like all these
tougher
awesome
stage.
Stories and songs. Like you got this great
general. No, but honestly,
general.
I think I did a good job of making Van Buren and Harrison likable. Yes. That is going to end with this president because he is not likable. He is.
So, yeah, I'll tease the calendar that we've been kind of working on in the background. Hopefully we might have this ready to go for next year, but otherwise it might be a calendar for 27. We don't know yet. But we were doing some research for that. I saw a little bit of spoilers ahead, and the wife was saying, like, I don't think John Tyler gets redeemed anywhere.
Oh, no. He died. I'll just tell you the ending. He dies shortly after voting to secede from the United States and as a member of the Confederate legislature.
So what's wild to me, though, is that, you know, John Tyler is on the Whig ticket, right?
Yes, he is. But
which
he's
is
only
like
on the Whig ticket to placate, well, to steal, let's say, to steal some of the Southern votes that are just inherently anti-Jackson, but want to be assured that they're still going to be allowed to own people.
Yeah.
So that doesn't frame exactly where John Tyler lines
okay.
up here.
Because it does not sound like the William Henry Harrison doesn't really sound like John Tyler is necessarily on board with the plan that he had put in place.
No, this is a means of convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is, this is not a, this was designed to defeat the Jacksonians. But like many times, if you have a position that's merely being the opposite of another position, when you finally get in power, a lot of times you're ineffective because your whole platform was just a mayor of the other one.
Yeah, what'd you say? If you want to combat radicalism, you got to be more centrist?
Yeah, radicalism by reciprocity. It's like people think like, oh, if I'm really far right, I got to somebody wants to counter that, be really far left. It's like, no, you're just creating more radicalism. Yep. You need to be a centrist.
Yep.
Like that's how that works. uncomfortably, that's how that works.
Right.
So John Tyler is, I'm not going to be able to redeem him, unfortunately. Like, not that's my job to redeem people. So most people know John Tyler for one thing, that he had a living grandson. His grandson was still alive.
That
his grandson died in 2024, just for the record.
Wasn't a show that you could watch? Like What's My Line or one of those or something?
Yeah.
One of those?
Yeah, he was on there's like an Ancestry show.
I've Got a
watched
Secret
it before,
or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was on I Got a Secret. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, he's on that one? Okay.
Yeah, so he had a grandson, Lion Gardner Tyler, who was one of John Tyler's kids, had a son really late in life also, Lion Gardner Tyler Jr., who was born in 1924 and died in 2020. And he also had another son, Harrison Ruffin Tyler. Great name, by the
Ruffin
way.
Ruffin is a good name. I like that name.
Just Harrison and Ruffin. Like, that is cool.
Is Harrison? We should bring Harrison back.
Harrison's a great
name. It's a good name.
One of my cousins, his son's named Harrison.
You
and
did?
I'm like, that's a great name.
Nice.
Harrison Ruffin Tyler was born in 1928 and passed away in 2023, which meant John Tyler, who was born in 1790, had a living grandson in 2023.
How is that even possible? That's freaking wild, isn't it?
Oh, well, we'll go through his family life. He had a lot of kids, and he had two wives. The only thing he had more of than kids was a cabinet changes. I have no way that I'm just, this isn't one of those like trickery ones where I'm trying to like trick Kyle into thinking that Martin Van Buren, that I hate Martin Van Buren. This is,
we don't hate Martin Van Buren.
Do we hate Martin Van Buren?
Oh, I thought it was still okay to call him a puppet and hate on him.
Oh no, we can still hate on him. I'm just saying he's more redeemed than Jackson.
But yeah, he's still he's still a puppet.
Yeah, I just don't like him. Like, I want to like him more.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like him more if he stood up a little bit more when, you know, he was actually, you know, running the presidency.
Yeah. I do like that he ran with John Adams' kid.
I do love that, and I also like that he turned around and said, go Lincoln.
Yeah, that's kind of awesome. This is not, but John Tyler did not do that. No. This is the anti-Martin Van Buren.
Right.
So, John Tyler, just like we mentioned before, he was born in 1790, March 29th. 1790. He was born on the Greenway Plantation. That's in Charles City County, Virginia. His dad's name was John Tyler Sr., which is really confusing to me because there's like
Why would he be a junior?
What's up?
How come he's not a junior?
Oh, that is funny. He's not a junior.
Huh. Right? Is that just the benefit of being a president? You can't have a junior as a president?
Yeah, I just realized that. Ah, I never noticed. That's a good point. I just kind of took that at face value. So he's born on the Greenway Plantation in Charles City County, Virginia. He's the son of John Tyler Sr., who was he was a jurist during the Revolutionary War. He was the speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates, and actually, eventually, his father became the governor of Virginia. So his father was the governor of Virginia, and then Mary Tyler was his mom. Now, much like every president that we seem to cover, there's always a horrific event in their childhood. And for John Tyler, his mom passed away when he was just 7 years old. And, you know, he obviously that's horrific. Mm-hmm. So while he was raised with all these, strappings of not just being the son of a wealthy plantation owner, but a very politically powerful man, he lost his mom really young. It from every account, like you would expect, it drastically affected him. Mm-hmm. So he lived in kind of this dual reality of like anybody at the time would be super envious of his upbringing, but he had this kind of like malaise from losing his mom so young. And sometimes I think we don't humanize the presidents enough, but that's a traumatic experience. That is a horrible traumatic experience. For a 7 year old, like a 7 year old losing their mom, it doesn't matter who they are, what they do, that's horrible. He enters college really young, but you don't really see him start his legal studies and legal training until a little bit later. The most founding fathers are starting their legal, not founding fathers, but yeah, it's kind of that same era. John Tyler's not a founding father. I'm just saying, like, that's similar.
Yeah.
1790s upbringing. Actually, usually tend to start their legal studies when they're like 17 or 18. He doesn't really start till he's 19, but he enrolled in college really early. So he was 12 years old when he enrolled in the College of William and Mary. And
the William and Mary. That's morals.
So as he's growing up within this prominent, Tidewater community, is kind of what his field of political philosophy came from, is this idea of very, very strict state rights constitutionalism. In other words, like the state, the Confederate, obviously they call it at the time, but the idea of Confederacy, the idea that like the states are more powerful than the national government, as opposed to federalism, which is the idea that the federal government's more powerful than the states, though the states have their own ability to act as present in the 10th Amendment, as we know from our amendment series. So he enrolls in College of William and Mary as a 12-year-old, which is insane to say. And he's really cool because as a 12-year-old, he's not going in there and practicing law. He's actually reading the classics. And he actually completes a course. They didn't say, like, if he got a degree from it, because back then degrees were a little different than they are today. But he completed classical studies, which would be, we would call that getting a degree in classical studies, before he went into law. So he was about 17, and he had a college degree in classical studies. Now, at this time, we tend to see, maybe the first year of an apprentice for a lawyer, but he essentially finished his studies in the classics and then started reading law, and he became kind of really obsessed. This is 1807, really obsessed with this Jeffersonian constitutional view. Mm-hmm. And this was very popular in the, you know, the town around Williamsburg, the town around William and Mary. And so he's like hyper obsessed with this idea of like Jeffersonian democracy, which is wild to think later in life he becomes a
Jacksonian almost.
I was going to say anti-Jacksonian because he's running on the Whig ticket. But the only reason he's running on the Whig ticket is that he's not like fully Whig. So he's like kind of Jacksonian.
Right.
That is funny. But so he ends up getting admitted to the bar by the time he's 19. So he's a real quick study. He starts a little later than the average person, but finishes a little earlier. Kind of funny. We don't talk about John Tyler as being this, you know, towering intellect. Kind of is.
No. Have we talked about schooling really too in general? Because like, you mentioned going to college, but was there wasn't really like grade school. There wasn't a school system in place.
He had tutors when he was like, you know, like around 10, a little earlier than 10, but he went to William & Mary in 1802. So he was 12 when he shows up to like one of the most prestigious colleges in the country now and today. So he ends up getting him into the Virginia bar in 1809. And I think this is kind of really cool. He goes back and practices law back in Charles City County near Richmond. Mm-hmm. Just goes back to his roots. He's not like, you think he, brilliant kid, brilliant child, all these political connections. Went to Williams and Mary's, which is at the time Jefferson's in office. So this is a bastion of like upward trajectory for attorneys. John Tyler's like, nah, I'll go home.
Yeah.
Went home. By all accounts, he had a very successful law practice. He was seen as like, he was seen as a judicial. He was very much like his father. He was seen as a scholarly. He was very strict states' rights constitutionalist. So he was also very well educated in the state constitution of Virginia, which obviously made him much more effective attorney. Well, after a couple of years, people start noticing him. They're like, hey, this guy's wicked smart. I don't think they said wicked, but like,
Not Virginia.
So he's elected. He wins a seat at just 21 years old to the Virginia House of Delegates. Yeah.
Huh.
Even more interesting. So at this time, you know, pretty much everybody's a Democratic Republican. He actually falls into the old Republican wing of the party. So the old Republican wing is just like Jeffersonian philosophy but like, don't think of like a Jeffersonian what was eventually bastardized into Jacksonianism. Think like 1798. Think like Jefferson before he ran against John Adams. Like, kind of this idea of like, anti-federalism, but the idea of anti-federalism is really because you like the idea of federal government, but you just want to make it not as strong. Mm-hmm. As opposed to countering federalism with states' rights.
Right.
Which, it's actually funny because we'll see over time, John Tyler eventually evolves a little bit away from that type of Jeffersonian wing. But what John Tyler is very open to this. What attracted him to that Jeffersonian viewpoint was the limited federal power. Now, what it's kind of like what I said, there's a difference in limiting federal power and limiting federal power to promote state power. Those are two different things.
Not limiting one and raising another one. Just difference between just lowering one and boosting the other one.
Yeah. And I don't think we talk enough about how like a lot of Jeffersonian views really were also heavily influenced by George Washington. We're also not George Washington being a political philosopher, but in George Washington's actions of him promoting the idea of the people above the state. And depending on how you feel, how Jeffersonianism kind of evolved from that viewpoint.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem to be nearly as consistent as like Washington's viewpoints. I mean, you think the government shouldn't be allowed to buy land and that you basically doubled the size of the U.S. in your first term.
Yeah, Jefferson really has a hard time escaping that hypocrite moniker. Right?
Yeah.
So he gets elected. He's in the House of Delegates. He's really, you know, jiving with the Jeffersonian wing. And then the War of 1812 kicks off. And he actually takes a role as a commissioned captain in a local militia company. So Kyle, right, companies like, what, anywhere from like 50 to 200 troops, depending on what it is. It's right above a platoon, right?
Yeah, you said a captain?
Yes, sir.
So it'd be like 03. So yeah, that seems reasonable. 50 to 200 men.
Yeah.
I did look it up though. A company is 50 to 100 men.
Okay, so 100. I was a little on the low side on that.
Yeah. And that was from 1812 numbers.
Oh, okay. Awesome. God, good job, dude. What a snipe. I love that. He didn't see any major combat. He really organized defense preparations for the James River region. But, you know, he even actually kept up with his delegate duties while he was a captain during the War of 1812. So, no, he did not have the illustrious military career like our friend Mr. Harrison, who was probably one of the most famous generals for real reasons, and also just overhyped reasons, as we talked about last episode. But, like, Harrison was a very competent general. Like, he was very good at commanding troops. Like, he was very good.
Sounds like he was a logistics wizard.
He loved logistics and maneuver warfare. He would have been fine today.
Like, right.
I'm just going to put my people in the best spot and make sure they have everything they need. It's like, congratulations, you've won 99.9% of battles historically. He gets married to his first wife, Latia Christian, and she's from New Kent County in Virginia. And they got married on November 12th, 1813. They actually wanted to have a very, very large family.
Didn't he have 14 kids or something ridiculous?
He had 15 total between both.
Oh my gosh!
And he had 14 that survived until adulthood.
Dude, that's wild in and of itself.
All right. Would you want me to try and name off all the kids that he had with his first wife?
No.
Okay.
But I'm going to let you do it anyway.
He had Mary Tyler Jones, Robert Tyler, John Tyler Jr., Latina Tyler Semple, she married later.
John Tyler the third.
It should be John Tyler the third, but it says John Tyler Jr.
Yeah, that's BS.
Elizabeth Tyler Waller. Ann Tyler, Elise Tyler, Tazewell Tyler. So his kids, just of note, Robert Tyler actually became the treasurer for the Confederacy, the treasurer for the Confederacy.
So he chose poorly too.
Right. Which is a horrible job. Like, you're the treasurer of something where people don't think you should be together. I have Confederacy money in one of those binders over.
Oh, is it still worth
that
nothing?
Binder? You know, it's so crappy. It's made of rice paper. And it looks like losers made it because it was made by losers. John Tyler Jr. became a Confederate officer. Let's see, who else?
I refuse to call him John Tyler Jr. He will be John Tyler the Third.
John Tyler the Third. And then Tazewell Tyler became a physician, but he ended up serving the Confederate Army also. So just a whole but a bunch of traitors. I stand by my opinions on these. If you fought for the Confederacy, I don't need to be nice to you.
I mean, it's not many people left to argue with you.
So he has his marriage in 1813. He shortly after that, he's reelected to the House of Delegates. And he actually built a reputation of being a very, very strict constructionist. And he was very skeptical of broad federal spending and banking schemes. And this is actually something that permeated throughout his life, to the point where he would actually go to odds with Jackson on some issues when it comes to banking. In other words, he was so anti-banking schemes that he was anti-banking scheme. Yes.
So abolishing the Second National Bank charter was not enough for John Tyler.
Yes, because there was the scheme of the pet banks was also a scheme to him. And I don't like the guy, but that is my level of consistency.
Right?
If you're going to be crazy, be crazy. He finished out his term as a member of the House of Delegates in Virginia, and then runs in 1816, how am I going to phrase that?
1816.
He ran in 1816 as a bid for the U.S. House of Representatives for the 15th Congress, and he's elected. He's elected as a Jeffersonian Republican, which is very interesting because given his trajectory of his career, it's kind of weird to think that he is seen as this very staunch Jeffersonian Republican. And he'll serve in there from 1817 to 1821, so he serves two terms. Very interesting cat while he's in there. So heavily, he is very, very, very much against federal spending, to the point of actually just more falling into the category as an obstructionist. He opposed several expansive internal improvement bills on constitutional grounds. So, and I want to be clear, as much as, you know, we can question John Tyler's morality and such as we go further on, this is very well, everybody kind of accepts that he was not arguing this for political points. He genuinely believed what he was arguing. And he was skeptical of the National Bank's constitutionality as a whole, which there is beautiful irony with him being a Jeffersonian Republican in 1817. And he's arguing against the constitutionality of a bank. Well, the guy he's named after bought a bunch of land that's clearly not allowed in the Constitution. But, oh, hypocritical people.
Yeah. How long did that party last?
Depends who you talk to. Some people say Jeffersonian Republicans kind of evolved into Jacksonian Democrats. I don't know if I believe that. To me,
pretty sure that party's ending soon, though.
Yeah. To me, it's a Democratic. He was a Democratic Republican.
Yeah.
Who just happened to fall on that side of that equation, but I'm sure somebody can argue different against that.
I'm sure someone will.
Yeah, I'm sure. Communism works beautifully.
No. There may not be a whole lot of John Tyler defenders out there. We might be okay on this one.
That'd be weird.
I know,
honestly,
right?
You're welcome on the show.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
So at this point, as we talked previously, like, we start to see the sectional tensions begin to grow in the United States. And he took a very pro-states right, very pro-southern position, especially in the Missouri Compromise. We start to see this turn that he'll commit to the rest of his career, where he's just heavily emphasizing state choice over federal restrictions. That states basically have the ability, I'm going to use a foreshadowing, to nullify federal laws they don't agree with. Yeah.
That doesn't last long, I don't think, does it?
No, it doesn't last long. And then it really doesn't last long after. After some northerners have to go down south. So he ends up leaving the House of Reps. A couple of different reasons. I personally think he was just fatigued because he had this such overly strict, non-compromising view that it made it difficult. I don't want to make it sound like he was a moral man. He had these strict, non-compromising views. No, when your strict, non-compromising views include the ability to own somebody else, you're not a moral man. You can be pig-headed. You can be stubborn and convicted and have
and
wrong convictions. Yeah, you can be consistent.
But you can't be moral.
Yeah. So he's reelected. A couple of years go by, and he's reelected to the House of Delegates in Virginia for his second of all, eventually be three stints. And he was very active on judicial and financial matters. Mm-hmm. And he keeps arguing for a narrow reading of federal power. So basically every time that something would come up, he would take the most word-to-word definition of what the feds meant, and then everything else was left interpreted to the state. So this kind of usurpation of federal law is a tactic that we see nullifiers of this time period use quite often.
This seems wild to me because the Founding Fathers, there's still some of them alive that you can go ask them what they meant when they wrote that. Why are you arguing that what they meant when they wrote something when you can go talk to the source?
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson's still alive.
Right?
Like, you can go talk. Yes. James Madison is still alive.
Right. Yes.
John Adams is still alive. John Quincy Adams
definitely is still alive.
In office. Yes. You can just go talk to his attorney general and be like, yeah, this is what he thought. So 1825 rolls around, and the General Assembly actually ends up electing him as he follows his father's footsteps and elect him as the 23rd governor. At this time, governors are only serving one term. Governors were kind of cool at this time frame. In Virginia, they were elected by the General Assembly, and they kind of functioned almost like prime ministers. So they had like 1 year terms.
It was only a year term?
I found that so interesting.
I thought they did like 6 year.
Governorships, I feel like, are very long now.
Right.
Well, while he's governor, he actually reorganized the militia administration, you know, from what he learned from the War of 1812. It's actually quite successful.
That Cush position, getting the militia ready for nothing to happen.
And he supported the founding of the University of Virginia. And he actually led a form. I think some of these are positive. He led a lot of legal education reforms and, you know, created a pretty strong financial environment which, as we know, there's the upcoming Panic of 1837.
Mm-hmm.
And he put Virginia in a fairly good spot. I mean, it was problematic because they were so export and agrarian focused that there was never a great spot he could put them in. But for more or less, I mean, he financially was a good steward.
Was he on board with Biddle's plan?
Biddle's plan hadn't come about yet. So
when that comes, we got to wait till night.
Dude, yeah. I would think, part of me thinks he would agree with it, but I don't know how he would interpret the federal overreach.
Yeah.
Like, is he okay if the bank acts separately to do this action? Especially Biddle did it from the Pennsylvania Charter Bank, so not as a bank endorsed by the United States. So he'd probably be cool with that.
Right.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking he'd be cool with it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He just thought the bank itself was a problem.
He didn't like the idea of like the federal government saying you are the bank.
I can see.
I don't agree with that, but like it's logical. Like again, you're not going to find anything illogical with him. Like it's
right.
weird.
Right,
even
right.
on the slavery issue, he's very consistent with his view on slavery. It's just disgusting.
Yes.
But it's consistent.
Consistently wrong, but it's consistent.
Consistently wrong. But he does set Virginia's legislature up in a position where this state rights becomes a mean of executive course. In other words, like what he's doing is he's essentially saying the governor gets to interpret what the federal statute is and how it should be used. And
ooh, that's an interesting precedent.
Yes, especially if we think what happens 30, 40 years down the road to that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of very much set a course I don't think Mr. Tyler knew, but supported. Clearly supported.
I mean, Mr. Quincy Adams was warning everybody.
Yeah, he called that shot.
I think he knew.
So after he finishes his term in governor, he's then elected to the U.S. Senate. He's chosen by the General Assembly. At this point, senators are not directly elected. They're elected by the state legislator. There was a vacant seat. He took it. And he comes in, man. It's 1827. This is right when things are starting to get a little weird, right? We're about to have the election of 1828. One of the most heated elections ever. Jacksonianism's running wild. The tariffs of abomination have been passed. Banking starting to, the Jacksonians are starting to target banking. And there's all this, John Quincy Adams pushed for all these internal approvals. Some of them got improvements. Some of them got blocked. Some of them got passed. They're causing tension. So he shows up and he immediately aligns himself with Jackson. He was a term that was used in one of the books that I love. He was initially sympathetic to Andrew Jackson's limited government rhetoric and distrust of the Bank of the United States. Then you have the nullification crisis that happens in, 1832, which is when states, basically it upheld that state right principles, but rejected nullification as remedy. And he actually supported the conciliation via the compromise tariff of 1833, which opposed the, if we remember, the force bill as an overreach. What all that mumbo jumbo basically means is we start to see that kind of like shift away from pure Jacksonianism that you think would be very appealing to Tyler, where he still has a little bit in him of like that federalism, just a little bit of the, no, he was not a federalist. He absolutely not. But that still idea of like, no, we don't need to have this civil war, right?
Right.
That he
right.
knew was a civil war at the time. But he, he did support the compromise tariff of 1833. He was able to stand on his opinions for the force bill. And he rejected nullification as a remedy, which is very surprising to a lot of his supporters. But here's, I said he hated banking schemes so much that he ended up falling out with Jackson. He
right.
actually ends up falling out with Jackson during the bank war. Because though he was super skeptical of the National Bank, he publicly condemned Jackson's removal of deposits as unconstitutional executive, aggrandizement is the term he used.
Wait, are you talking about when Jackson was pulling out the money to go try to get back to the States?
When he was pulling out money to put into pet banks. So not the profit. And voted on the Senate's 1834 censure of Jackson.
Huh.
Which is crazy. Like just completely, within 2 years flips around. But again, he's not flipping around. I want to be very clear.
No, he's
not flip-flopping. Yeah. He's the same. Everything's moving around him. he ends up, this becomes crazy. So he ends up breaking towards the end of his time there. He ends up breaking with the Virginia Democrats because the Virginia legislator instructed the senators to support expunging the censure of Jackson. And Tyler refused. He was like, nope, I stand by my principle. He deserved to be censured. And they're all like, you know, Tyler's in this weird spot because he's this, you know, he has this reputation of being a very principled man. Again, you don't have to like his principles, but he's a very principled man. That's how he's seen. He held every elected position he possibly could. He was, even though he didn't see combat, he was a retired military officer. Like, it's kind of like, you don't want to mess with this guy. And even as rampant as Jacksonians are, even they're kind of like, I don't know if I want to, if this may not be the guy I go after, because he'd be a big problem for me later on.
Right. Pick your battles.
So what does Tyler do amongst all this, you know, essentially political chaos that's not productive?
Goes and joins forces with William Henry Harrison.
Yeah, he resigns. Exactly. So in 1836, he resigns. He resigns his Senate seat rather than violate his previously stated constitutional position or flout, you know, state institutions. And he sees this man of principle with these emerging Whig tendencies. I want to be clear. Not Whig alignment,
that's
Whig
what
tendencies.
Got him on there. Okay. Okay. Because so, that's what the thing I've been trying to figure out is how you can take somebody with such diametrically opposed views on several key issues and still put them on your ticket.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so in 1836, which is the election that Martin Van Buren wins, but the Whig really run their first major ticket. They're running multiple regional presidential candidates against Van Buren. Weird strategy, but actually, like, today that makes no sense. Back then, it was actually kind of a smart strategy.
One of the things we talked about, too, in the election of 1840 was how it was the first time, like, there was an actual, like, political machine behind it, like an actual organized campaign. Was a lot of that learnings from this election?
Bingo. So, basically, take all those regionalization efforts and make them into, combine them. What do you get? National campaign.
You get a presidential campaign. Very good campaign. Guy. Okay, okay.
So, the Southern Whigs got together, and for their region, they backed Hugh Lawson White. There's a bunch of stuff actually named after Hugh Lawson White and his family, just for the record. Right? Just like when I was researching, I was like, oh, crap, it's like a billion things named after him. Tyler was placed as the vice president for that region's effort. Obviously, Van Buren wins the election, and the Senate elected Richard M. Johnson vice president after Virginia's electors balked. So basically, it caused a stalemate for the vice presidency nomination out of Virginia, or voting out of Virginia, because people like Tyler so much. But because of all this hullabaloo, Tyler ends up gaining like all this national attention. Right. And he's seen as this unique animal, a states' rights-focused Whig, which it just doesn't exist. Like, Whigs are they're not proto-Republicans, right? I don't want to say that that's like a, I don't know, man, that's not. And for people like, the Whigs are the predecessor of the Republican. No, they weren't. That's like saying Jacksonian Democrats are the predecessor of the Democratic Party. No, like, it's not. It's a lazy man argument.
When the Republicans are formed, they are like a militant.
They're abolitionists.
Right,
yeah. So they believe in ending slavery now.
There's a lot
of radical arms of the abolition movement. I mean, it says a lot when the first Republican elected causes the Civil War because not that he did anything. Is that they said, oh my God, the Republicans have gotten elected. We need to, the opposition was like, oh my, we need to start a war. I do think it's crazy to think just what that looked like. Like, we don't really have a modern equivalency to it, that a new party's elected and wants to radically change something that has been a thorn in the side of the United States' ability to operate for, at that time.
At this point, 50
years? 90
years? 60, 90?
Yeah, 1776, let's say 80 years.
Actually, probably go back further than that.
Yeah, I was just saying the United States is an independent country. Like, think of it, they elected a party, and the party's like, hey, what'd you form? Well, we all got together in Wisconsin. We decided that we're ending slavery. Over what period? Now. It's like, oh.
Grab your gun. Oh,
are you willing to discuss that? No. And then they won. And people are like, interesting. So what's your next move? We're ending slavery. It's like, that was our one part of our platform. It's like, interesting. Unless you see like some guy in South Carolina like loading up a cannon. Like, we're gonna have to stop this. He ends up getting to this national you know, this national procedure is this very rare states' rights focused wig. And, you know, it's, you know, it's interesting because his time between 1840 election is really spent. He's in his third stint at the House of Delegates, easily wins re-election. I mean, and again, he's not winning re-election because he's some part of some political dynasty, right? He is part of a political dynasty, but he's winning because he's seen as a principled Virginian who loves serving his local people. And he's like, you know, they just like him. He's a likable guy.
Dude, there's something to be said for consistency, too. Like, at least, you know, he's got a track record of doing the same thing when he's been in there, especially when pushed, right? Like, that's, there's something to that.
He gets back into office, and what does he do? He wants to lower taxes because he wants low spending. He advocates for hard money. And I want to be clear. The type of hard money that Mr. Tyler was advocating for is not the same sense of what Jackson did in 1837. He is talking about hard money more as a way to maintain confidence in the use of dollars than he is in kind of a way to curb speculation.
So he wants a reserve to back the currency?
Yes, that's exactly.
Okay.
You said it better than me, Kyle. And I want to be clear about that because I don't think it's fair that everybody in this time period, I sound like an economist right now, but everybody in this time period, but it's what I am, makes everybody who advocates for hard money sound like a Jacksonian. He's not. He's literally saying, like, hey, guys, now at this point in time, there's no Federal Reserve. So, like, seniorage is a thing that he's scared of. Now, seniorage is when you print money to pay, government prints money to pay its bills and it causes inflation. And Tyler, for more or less of what you may think of him, believe that government needs to spend low and that inflation is stealing wealth. And so if you have a hard currency and you have low federal spending, you're not going to get any inflation. Was he a great economist? No. Do I agree with that? No, not really. I do like low spending. That makes sense to me. But, you know, I have the luxury of having a Federal Reserve to make me sound smarter than I actually am. He didn't.
See, we talk about putting the people in the mind or going into the mindset of the people. Like, think of John Tyler, think of 1840s or whatever the time frame this is, and the idea of money just being something that we all agree is worth what it is. Like, that, I don't think anybody from that time period is going to wrap their head around that.
No, and there's no lender of last resort because there's no Federal Reserve. The National Bank's debt, like, I would probably agree with him at the time about the hard money side.
I think, yeah.
Because it's going to meter itself. And plus, like, John Tyler is a smart man. He's a smart man. He sees what happens in England when they have to jack up interest rates on money they're lending. And, like, again, I want to be clear. Like, and I think I was very clear about this when we did that episode. Like, England wasn't doing that to punish us or to be mean to us. But at this time,
no, they're protecting themselves. That's a risk. Yeah.
Our relationship with England's actually pretty good. And England was basically like, oh my God, we're just like our coffers are just emptying of gold. Like,
right.
And that's what we do. That's a free market. Oh, if people are exploiting something, then you raise the price, you raise the interest rate until it normalizes. Here's the other thing. England, well, they put, like, they banned the Atlantic trade. It was only for like 6 months. It was literally them banning it until they rebuilt up their gold supply. It wasn't like they were being punitive, like, at all.
Right.
In fact, they were cool with, like, Nicholas Biddle's idea of, like, buying cotton and pushing it onto the market, and people would be like, oh, Eric, but, like, that helped them because British textile industry was taking off. Yeah, they also had colonies everywhere that were producing cotton. Like,
yeah.
And they were cool with, like, it's easy to paint England in that time frame as being, like, not caring and doing something punitive. No, they were literally cool with everything going on besides, like, their vaults emptying, and they were like, hey, you can still borrow from us, but we're just going to apply a higher interest rate, which, dude, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but, like, that higher interest rate probably helped recover from the recession a lot quicker than anything we did. So, Kyle, one of the things I wanted I've written down in my notes right here real quick is, you know, as we're discussing kind of the actions that England is taking to protect itself, and Tyler's seeing this, and so Tyler's advocating for this hard money. See, this is the only thing that stinks about me researching this is I see stuff I want to text you.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I can't text you because then it would ruin, like, So, like, I occasionally put little tags on stuff and, like, bother Kyle on.
Yeah,
so
this is what I'm going to do it after the fact.
Yeah. So this is what I'm specifically going to not just work in to see your response. I'm going to call out because that was interesting.
Okay. All right.
So Tyler was very focused on this idea of, like, incorruptible value of money, that a dollar is going to be worth X amount of gold no matter what the prices of other goods are. And he did not like the idea, and you probably see where I'm going with this. He never seemed to be a supporter, though he never was, like, overly against it, of bank reserves, as in, like, the bank having extra dollars relative to how many dollars it's supposed to be worth to gold. So in other words, like a fractionalized banking system before there was fractionalized banking. But one of the historians I read, and she's more of an econometricist, so he's more like an economist, referred, and I really love this, that Tyler was, because he wrote a little bit on this too, was anti-margins. Anti-like trading margins. Oh. That idea of the, basically he viewed banks as trading on margins.
As you were explaining that, it was actually sounding to me like he was anti-trading.
Yeah, I think he was.
Wild. I wonder what the speculator scene was looking like at that time, because there was a market at this point in time. There were speculators, right?
Yes. Land speculation had collapsed at this point. But I want to be clear. There was still, and this is where I think Tyler and the historian and the Cleometrics I was reading went, and that's why I want to bring it up to you. Banks still had stocks, and bank stocks could be traded. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering now, was Tyler, I mean, he was
trying to say like a stock needed to stay the same value, like no matter what? Like, what?
Yes. I think his whole idea was that, like, if the bank value can't change and they can't lend on margin, then in theory, the stocks would all be worth the same all the time. And therefore, there wouldn't be like banking runs and banks wouldn't be like commoditized.
You say he was a genius?
No, I think he didn't understand like financial markets.
Like, you don't understand the value creation that gets added when a company does certain actions?
My question is, where did he think interest went?
Right? Like, also, why do you not want reserves? That's a weird thing, too, to get upset about.
All right, so thank you. So this is a weird thing I couldn't get my head around. And again, now, we're now entering, these are things Tyler, he didn't say these, he didn't write these down, but his actions and viewpoints, we're trying to analyze those, right?
Right.
I'm, like, genuinely confused on, like, how he thought banking worked.
Right.
Where, like, it sounded like he wanted the bank to be a depository, where, like, there was $1 million in gold, and there was $1 million in dollars, and you just went and traded those in.
He didn't think that the bank should be, like, loaning out the money that they've collected kind of thing.
So, like, that's the other thing. I couldn't figure out, like, and this could be, like, rich man brain he might have about, like, oh, where do you get the money to, like, the whole idea that why banks are valuable is, like, they create markets where you have a transfer of savings to demand, as therefore expressed by interest, by an interest rate, into actual use of those dollars. Otherwise, they would just be sitting non-active in a safe. Yeah. And, like, I don't think he understood that. I think he was just like, banks are imaginary.
Banks are a safe where I stick my money and I want it to be there when I come to go pull it out.
Yes.
I think that's his mindset right there.
And I think it's hilarious that he was anti-Jackson. Because it made me realize that when he says he's against bank, like he describes like being anti-banking schemes, I think he's just anti-banking. Like, I don't think he actually understands what banking is.
I think he just, yeah. You know.
Like, I think he was like, do you think he like walked around Virginia and was like, guys, do you know what they're doing at the bank? Like, if you give them $1,000, they'll lend out $500 to other people, but tell you they still have their thousands. And I was like, yeah, John, that's how banks work. That's crazy.
Why do you think you're getting a payment every month on the money that you deposited?
So, like, my question is, like, where do you think the guy he would go to trade his gold for dollars? Like, I wonder how he thought that guy was getting paid.
Right?
Like, I'm really curious. Like, where do you think he makes his money? Yeah, it was very funny. I just thought, like, oh, he's just anti-banking. Like, I don't think he's pro-hard money. I think he's anti-banking.
I think that's what it sounds like. Maybe he doesn't like the institution. Does he not like bankers?
That's gonna be it. So as he's, you know, as his national profile rises, and as we move towards what will be next week's episode, which is election and presidency, what drives his success? Bridging of factions. You know, he increasingly is seen as this pro-state rights Whig who can build and have good discussions and connections with Southern Whigs, which are vastly needed to support, to make a national ticket. Northern Whigs, you know, they do look at him as somebody who is focused on economic recovery and who understands that, you know, restricted government spending needs to happen. especially if you think the North is this, you know, massive exporting area of the value added exporting area of the country. So the last thing they want to do is see, you know, it's okay to have it's good to have a weaker currency if you're a net exporter, but when you have to import in goods to, you know, to do the value add process, that can really stink. That can actually destroy your ability to function as an exporting nation. It's actually what like happened to Italy. So he's able to build this bridge, and he's seen as this build this bridge builder, which is ironic because, as we'll cover in next week's episode, he'll end his life sitting in the Congress of the Confederacy.
No kidding.
Yeah. And voting to secede from the Union.
Traitor.
Traitor. Traitor is the accurate description of him. Like, absolutely.
Oh man, there's no redemption arc this time.
No, sadly.
All right, well, it is probably a good spot though to probably end this part one. So please join us next week as we continue shining our spotlight on the Tyler II fine print of Harrison's presidency. Also, Tyler II, I think, was actually spelled TWO. Now that we learned that he was a junior,
I just love that they keep doing like junior, senior, junior, senior, junior, senior.
Right? Like, no, one of you guys is a third. I hate to say it.
We don't count that high. Right? That's well, mean. He's a very smart man. I don't know why I made something his intelligence.
While you're waiting for part two to come out, please open up a history book. Fill in the comments with all the mistakes that we made. And if you give me timestamps, I'll turn them into shorts for you. If you don't want to shame us publicly, you can email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com. We'll do it ourselves by reading anything sent to us on air. Hit the thumbs up, sub on your favorite platform, visit the website at Buck Starts Here Podcast, stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.